I'm Laurie Duggan. I'm a poet. I've published two books of poems so far. The names of my books are East and Under the Weather. My new book, which possibly will come out later this year, is called Adventures in Paradise. As well as poetry, I've been involved in other sorts of writing. I have been working very tentatively at a history of East Gippsland, Victoria. My new book, Adventures in Paradise, is roughly divided into two sections. The second section features material that's largely satirical, and also a second, an autobiographical poem, which is the title poem. The first section has some material in it which I guess you could term historical. There's also a fair amount of a fairly political poem. I think most of the poems in the book are, to some extent, political. A poem called Crawling from the Wreckage, which is a collage of media happenings over the space of a week. It's largely taken from listening to Parliament on the ABC and listening to assorted radio serials and bits and pieces like that and welding them together. The first part of the book begins with two quotations, one from an American writer called Michael Leasy, from a book he published in 1973 called Wisconsin Death Trip. Over a period of 40 years, an analogy between city and country life was implied, denied, and then transformed into an illusory choice between distinct civilizations. It is this imaginary choice, put under a walnut shell and pushed about the table like a pea for 60 years, that makes us even now believe that there is somewhere else to go. I followed this quotation with another short quote, which is an Australian saying which dates from the 1880s, apparently, which is, the forests pay no rates. And I think what's implied there is that perhaps the best thing you can do is cut them down and make settlements. I remember very little, in fact, about my school, both my primary school and my high school. I think I've suppressed it. I don't think I enjoyed it very much. My handwriting was something that gave me a lot of trouble, in fact, because when I was at primary school, they were still using dip pens, and I'm both left-handed and rather backhanded as well, so that I'd push the pen across the page and smudge everything after it. And I think in one year I was subsequently the only kid that was allowed to write with a ballpoint pen, because otherwise they couldn't read what I'd written. When I was at high school, my writing started to get very flat and very, like, my writing would just degenerate into a line that looked like a seismograph with very little activity going on. And once it got to the point where I had difficulty reading it myself, I stopped and started printing instead. Now I usually print with a ball pencil. I don't know if you'd call it calligraphy. Interestingly, there's an American poet whose work I admire very much called Philip Wayland, who has an amazing style of handwriting. It's incredible looking writing, and when I bucked up the courage to write him a letter and got a reply, I saw that writing, which I'd seen printed in magazines, in facsimiles beforehand, and thought, well, he writes like this all the time, you know. My writing's pretty much the same for all purposes, whether it's shopping lists or manuscripts. I began writing in 1966 when I was at high school. In some ways, I guess it was a fairly late beginning. I was about 17. I certainly didn't start writing when I was 12 or 13. In fact, I wasn't in the least interested in poetry or literature until about my 16th year. I was mainly interested in fighter aircraft of the Second World War and history, in fact, which has remained an interest which has remained with me. I don't think I wrote anything that I really wanted to hang on to until about 1970 or 71. I'm not entirely sure what made me start writing poems. I think a bit before I'd started to do that, I'd thought that I'd like to be more or less a high school fantasy. I wanted to be a painter, and I certainly wasn't any good at painting. Then I wrote a few stories, which I kept on writing, and I started writing poems. I still kept writing stories, and at the time I didn't really think of the poems as being particularly important in relation to the stories, but of course I haven't written anything like a story since I was at high school, and I've kept writing poems. Before 71 I really jumped from one style to another. I think basically I was doing the right thing, which was trying to imitate as many different sorts of writing as possible. I'd try to write like Keats, I'd try to write like T.S. Eliot, I'd try to write like Ezra Pound, and dismally fail on all three. Then early 1971, I wrote a couple of poems that I haven't really published in any of my books, but which were the poems that really got me started. One of them was called Gauguin, and it was a very cryptic little five-section poem based on looking at different paintings by the painter, executed at different periods of his life. The other one was one called Crossroads, which was totally an opposite sort of thing. Instead of being cryptic, it was very loose. It was a number of sections that came about when I was making another trip for a limited period. I'd come up to Sydney for about a month, Christmas 1970, New Year 1971, and I wrote that over that period. And coming to Sydney, just getting away from Melbourne, was like a big buzz for me at the time. When I was at university, at Monash University, between 1968 and 71, prior to that, I'd had no contact with any poets at all. There was a literature club which had about 15 to 20 regulars, which used to organise readings every month or so. And there I met John Scott and Alan Wern, both writers that I'm still on very friendly terms with. They're still good friends of mine. I see them regularly. Another thing that happened was that Alan Wern was originally organising the poetry readings for the Literature Club. He did this in 1968. And in 1969, he shifted from Monash to La Trobe Uni, but we still kept up contact. John Scott was meanwhile only doing part-time study at Monash, and so I took over from Alan organising the poetry readings, which I did for 1969, after which the club folded due to lack of interest. We'd structure our readings by getting a guest reader who was usually someone who'd achieved some kind of prominence or respectability as a writer. But what happened at these readings mainly was that the guest reader was really only called in to hang our own readings about. I suppose we worked in it pretty much from our own egos. Some of the readings were quite riotous, and in fact what often happened, unfortunately for the guest reader, is that unless they impressed the Monash poets, they didn't really get much of a go. Meanwhile, all the crazies had have a chance to read with someone else's name as a draw card. Since then, I suppose, the next group of people that I met that really had anything much to do with writing were people from Sydney. There were a lot of writers in Carlton and around the La Mama circuit at the time that I was in Melbourne, but I had very little contact with them. I did go and see a lot of theatre and performance at La Mama, mainly because I knew a couple of people that were in Tribe Theatre Group, but I never went to any poetry readings there until fairly late in the piece. We were always, at Monash, we were always a bit suspicious of the people at Carlton and La Mama, and I think that they were suspicious of us too. I mean, they thought, because we were associated with a university, which to my mind is purely coincidental, we just happened to meet there and be there, I think we were seen as being a bit academic possibly, which we certainly didn't feel ourselves to be. I mean, we felt that there were academic poets that were coming from Melbourne University largely. So the next lot of people that I met that I've kept up much contact with were people from Sydney. When I came up for a month in over the new year of 1970 to 71, I knew nobody in Sydney, but I was given an address by one of my friends in Tribe Theatre, of a woman who'd been in Tribe Theatre previously and was now living in Sydney, Diana Fuller. So I stayed at her place, and living at her place was Pam Brown, who wrote and still writes poetry and whom I've still kept up contact with. All this was compounded by the coincidence that Pam's birthday is the same day as mine, so we've had something mutual to celebrate through the years. It also, I've found out since, is apparently, from what they can work out, Dante's birthday in 1265, which is a very happy occurrence. It's Walt Whitman's on the next day. But I'm rambling. When I was up in Sydney at the time, I met Bob Adamson and John Tranter. The previous year, John Scott had won the Poetry Society of Australia Award. He'd gone up for a presentation. It was, in fact, the last time they had a big presentation for the award. And he'd met a few people, and I'd got a few addresses off him. So when I came up about a month later, I promptly went round and visited Bob Adamson and John Tranter as well. Going back to Melbourne after that was a bit of a letdown. Midway through 71, I went to the Canberra Arts Festival. At the Canberra Arts Festival, I met another bunch of people from Sydney. They were from Sydney Uni. They were Terry Larson, Martin Johnston, and Andrew Huntley. Now, the three of them used to give really good readings because each of them was so totally different from the other one. But all three of them were, to some extent, really good performers. Nobody I knew had really been as extroverted as that. And I think that was one of the big things that drew me to Sydney as well. I think I always associated the place with extroversion. I did my third year of English Honours at Monash in 71. That was the year in which I'd come up to Canberra mid-year, and the Christmas before I'd been up to Sydney. And I decided that year that I really wanted to move to Sydney, so I thought, well, I'll just finish third year Honours. I didn't intend to do fourth year Honours because I didn't know who the hell I was going to write a thesis about. And also by that stage I felt that the English department wasn't really furthering my writing, and by that stage I think I was interested enough in being a writer to see that as being first and foremost and not to worry about university. So then I arranged to do 2 years of fine arts at Sydney University, which I had a year off, and I did those part-time in 73 and 74. So I moved up to Sydney in February 1972. I was unemployed for a few months early in 1972. At that stage I moved into a house which Terry Larson was also living in at Petersham. But about midway through 72 I got a job in the City of Sydney Public Library, and I more or less supported myself over those years working library full time. That brings me up to halfway through 1976, when I decided I never wanted to ever work in library again. I left Sydney then and spent about 6 months in Melbourne. I had no intention of staying in Melbourne at the time. I hitchhiked down around the coast. I knew some people in Bega, Avril Fink, who is also a poet, and Greg McManus, whom she was living with. Stayed at their place, came across an old Austin A95, which cost me $90, quite by accident, and drove down to Melbourne. I still thought I was just going to stop in Melbourne for a few weeks and then go inland somewhere, travel around a bit, but John Scott was at that time teaching at Swinburne Institute in the Media Studies department, and he said to me, "Would you want a job for a semester?" And I said yes, so I took it up. So I co-taught first year Media Studies with John for the second half of 76. And then after that, moved back to Sydney again, basically because I had no intention of staying in Melbourne and the job was only for a limited period. Since then, I've been in turn unemployed and unemployable. And recently, I've been working in libraries again. I'll just go back again at this point. When I arrived in Sydney, I'd by then written the title poem of my first book, which was called East, which is in fact about East Gippsland, and is also a sort of a cut-up in that it's... I did a fair bit of research on it. I went through old newspapers, history books, photo albums, various things, and used captions, headlines, a section reprinted intact from a newspaper. Well, in fact, it isn't intact. It has been edited, but it's been printed to look as though it's a newspaper column. And that poem won the Poetry Society Award at the end of 71. I'm just going to read four sections from the poem East, starting from... That'll be the last four sections, starting from five. Two hotels. The new Little River Inn, Calcutta Corner, where Indian hawkers camped by Costello's hayshed. Barman, Jim Culane of Crooked River. Miss Kushla Jones, the Omeo Orchestra, one of the finest dance bands in all Gippsland. Ensay South Hotel, established 39. 20 years later, the Omeo Highway rerouted. Once busy hotel, an isolated backwater. January 67, 6th, 9th, 10th. Visited Bindi Station with Uncle Jack, George Hardridge. Fished in Little River, sterling and haunted stream, denser than myth. Clary the dingo trapper, his dogs hung in the huge freezer, old South Ensay pub. 1939. Friday, January 13th, 1939. Graphic bushfire narratives. Truck bound, doing 80, missed the bridge, churned sideward, water, flames, put overhead. Ellen. The air here is black, 3 o'clock, afternoon, and all our lamps are on. Omeo, the golden age, burnt to the ground. Fire died under rain, the shadow of war. Living figures, numerals. J.A. Duggan, 36 Squadron, tool setter, GMH. Late visit to Swift's Creek, return through heavy rain, shapes of timber mills and sawdust burners. Books, utensils, pianola rolls, memorial swimming pool, trash and treasure centre. 1917. Despite the Argus, February 12, 1912, cleric speaks out against mixed bathing. Kaiser Bill, Mother Country and Mr. Hughes, a fondness for trivia persists. Tired of piano, the picture house, with all our hearts. Teeth white from government film clips, breasting trenches, on his back. 2 foot mud, Jesus and poison gas. Reciprocates a bleeding grin to sky. The field forever England and Uncle George. Far corner of the earth's core. And we must lose sight of birth, death, a cabin on the Tambo, sides burst with 10 children, too much for us. Clayton West, 2. The new month, 7 a.m, before vilification, a street of houses, its own strange beauty, holds no alien note. The given grid accepted, viable. Melbourne, fine, sunny periods, maximum 75. Massive hearing gives verdict on massacre. Landscape of words, jerry-built ugliness of place, name. Discarded as a key to spurious meaning, squalor of testimony. M.F. Duggan died 1962. Life or symbol, death or caesura. Compare, contrast selected passages with special reference to poetic qualities. Commandos thrust deep into Laos. I could say about that poem, I guess it was in fact pretty strongly influenced by having read the Ern Malley poems. On the one hand, the way that I've manipulated the dates around, on the other, I think is probably more due to having read William Faulkner. I might just explain a couple of bits and pieces about that, the section that I've just read. There's a lot of play in it with various things. A section where I say, Omeo, the Golden Age burnt to the ground. In fact, Golden Age is printed in block capitals to indicate that I'm not referring to the Golden Age, but to, in fact, a Golden Age, which happens to be a pub. The cover of the book East is, in fact, a photograph taken in the early 1920s showing my father, aged about 12 at the time, and another boy, both dressed in Shakespearean costumes for a school play, standing in front of a hill which is so obviously an Australian landscape it makes the figures look a bit as though they're cutouts that were pasted onto it. I could add a few things more about the book East at this point. The poems that were in it were written between 1970 and 74. The book was published in 76. The first half of the book was largely written in Melbourne and the second part in Sydney. I forgot to mention that one of the other people I met in Sydney, whom I didn't actually meet until I moved up, was John Forbes, whom I've also kept up a lot of contact with, and we in fact co-edited a magazine, Surface Paradise, which the first issue of it came out in about November 1974. It was a gazetted magazine with a screen-printed cover. The second one John edited by himself, and that came out the beginning of 1979, so you could say it's an irregular publication. I haven't got any one particular way of writing or approach to writing. I've written things that have gone through numerous drafts that have been added to. I've written things that have been written in notebook form, which the process of turning it into a poem has been more cutting things out. And again, I've written things that have pretty much gone straight down onto the paper and been relatively unchanged. A good example of this from my new manuscript from Adventures in Paradise is the poem called The New England Ode, which is a longish poem that, in fact, I wrote it more or less at one sitting and only changed two or three words, where I'd been up in New England, I'd been bushwalking, and I had to get back to Sydney quickly because my second book, Under the Weather, there was going to be a launching party for it that very night. So I booked a plane to fly down. So I had about 4 hours to wait in Armidale before catching the plane, and I thought I'd do a pub crawl. And I only ended up going to two pubs because the second one I thought was right on the plaza, and it had a window that overlooked the plaza, and I thought, oh, why not, I'll stop here. And at the second one, I'd begun to write this particular poem. I just got my notebook out and started writing stuff. And I wrote a long first section in that pub. Then I got a taxi to an airport, and I wrote the shorter second section in the plane over another can of beer. By the time I'd reached Sydney, I was pretty drunk, but I'd finished a poem. And I promptly put it in my bag, went home, had a shower, went to a Chinese restaurant, had a huge meal so I could cope with the alcohol at the poetry launching. And sometimes, really late in the night, I was talking to Carl Harrison Ford, who's another one of the people I met when I first came up to Sydney. And I said, oh, look, I'll write this poem today. And I dragged it out of my bag and read it to him. And he said, oh, that's terrific. And the next morning I thought, oh, was it just because he was drunk and I was drunk? I was really embarrassed about looking at the poem again because I just read it without having done anything to it. And I read it and I was quite happy with it, except for about two or three words. But I think the actual writing of it, there are a number of things that I'd been thinking about on and off over the last few months that just happened to gel. And then I was in that situation, a cram situation, where I was just... It was almost like being sat down at a desk in a strange room and told to fill as many pages with writing as you can in the next 15 minutes or 20 minutes. Under the Weather, my second book, is pretty different to East. East was really just a collection of things that I had done over a certain period, whereas Under the Weather is in fact one poem. It's in 12 sections from memory, but it's all pretty much the one thing. It was written over about 2.5 year period, from about the very beginning of 1975 I started writing it, and I wrote the last things in it midway through 76 before I... Oh no, that's not right, no. I wrote the last things in it, in fact, in 77. It was all more or less written in notebooks, and I didn't start thinking about it as a book until I'd written about half of it. I just wanted to get away from the sorts of poem that I'd been writing, the very compressed, very formal poems. So I just started writing notebooks as a matter of course. The book was published by Wild and Woolley in late 1978. The book got uniformly bad reviews. Everyone disliked it. But apparently a newspaper in Newcastle, although I haven't been able to verify this, wrote a review under the impression that I was a woman, which was rather interesting, because somebody else wrote a review in an Institute newspaper in Sydney, misreading a couple of sections of the book and claiming as a result that I was an incredibly sexist male chauvinist writer. Over the two books that I've had published and the one that's in the can waiting to be published, I've changed the style that I've written in considerably. The first book has got some fairly formal things in it. The second book is apparently very loose, very free form. And the third one has poems that are in fact written in orthodox meters in it, alongside poems that are apparently free form, poems that are cut ups of news broadcasts, prose poems. I don't like sticking at the one thing for terribly long. I think unless I can write something that's quite different from what I've written before, I'm not very happy. I know people that can go on writing things in similar style, but I certainly can't. I think in all the things I write, I do very consciously hear them as I write them. I'm pretty attentive to how they sound. I mean, that's what they are, basically. With one of the latest things that I've done, the unit is not so much the word or the phrase, but it might be a line or a sentence, so that within, or even a paragraph, so that within that paragraph, the paragraph itself, you might find things that seem pretty rhythmically rough. But I then try and relate that paragraph to what comes after it, because I suppose in some ways I'm a sort of an anarchist in terms of writing, in that I don't really believe that there are any rules. I think that rules are only things that are determined by what people have seen in writing that's already been done. The Poetics of Aristotle is like that. I mean, it's merely a description of the styles of writing that were available for him to peruse. And the mistakes made when this becomes prescriptive instead of descriptive, when you say good writing must be done in such a way, I think history is the only thing that will tell whether writing's good or not. Delight, I'd say, is what I'm mainly after in a piece of writing, which is not to say that I'm not awfully worried and bored and depressed over long periods of time, but I've chosen what I'm doing. I'm happy to do it. I wouldn't do it any other way, and I don't think if I had a chance to repeat it, I don't think I'd do it any differently.